Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about.
This week on the Garden DC podcast, we're joined by Maryland native Claire Jones. She's a garden designer, author, horticulturist, floral designer, and beekeeper. Welcome, Claire.
Hi, Kathy.
So good to have you on. So Claire and I have known each other for years, both as professional garden communicators and members of the GardenCom Association. And today I wanted to talk to Claire all about keeping backyard honeybees. But before we dive into that, Claire, I wanted you to tell our listeners a bit about yourself and your background. You have so many different hats, like many of us, and I think you work for yourself
well
as a solopreneur. So there's so many different avenues we can explore. Let's start with your garden designer background.
Okay. Well, I design gardens and I own a landscape design build service. And that just means I go out to people's houses and see that what they want to do. And I do specialize in native plantings. But I can do anything. I can do a screen between you and your neighbor, which is really my most requested thing. Nobody wants to look in their neighbor's yards, and drainage. I'll do a drainage project. But my favorite would be, you know, of course, a bee garden, pollinator garden, flower borders, anything to do with flowers and shrubs and trees. I can design it, and then I have people do the work for them, install it. And I even do maintenance, and I work in the greater Baltimore area.
Great. So for your clients, you say you design, install, and build. You have a crew working with you. It's not just you, correct?
Yes, I have a crew that I call on. But, you know, I kind of work on my own for the first design process, and then I pull in who I need to pull in. It could be an electrician, it could be a stonemason, a carpenter, somebody who can grade a property. So whatever I need, I hire and I supervise them to make sure the work is done properly.
Wow, it's a great service because so many of us, it's the hiring the right person and then being able to get that job done. That's the key part.
Yeah, because so I stay with it from conception to the finished product.
Cool. So what led you to garden design? Were you a lifelong gardener, Claire? Were you gardening, as a tot, or when did you start?
Well, I've gardened all my life. I can't even remember when I started. You know, I have always done it, and I love doing it. I love digging in the dirt. And I graduated from college with my degree in sociology, not thinking I could really put a gardening career for me. But, you know, I started in the business world. I worked for the phone company and I hated it. And I said, I really want to be outside working in gardens, designing gardens. So I started working with a landscape design company, and I worked there for 17 years. And this was a full service company that does lawns, maintenance, everything. And then after a while, after 17 years, I was like, you know, Claire, you can do this all by yourself and make more money. And that's what I've done. I started my own business, and I had made all these contacts through my years with the landscape design company. And then I just started doing it on my own. And now my husband, who is out of work from you know, with COVID, I got so busy with my landscape work that I said, come on, you help me. So he's been helping me at different jobs.
Wow, it's great that you can pull him in for that. And so your sociology degree, does that come into play at all, say, with working with clients and customers?
Yeah, of course, it does. It has greatly helped me with client relationships. And I also worked with the phone company a long time ago in the business world, and I worked in customer service. And they taught you how to talk to people, you know, like the customer's always right, et cetera. But it really gave me a good background to go in and talk to people, because I talk to all kinds of people. I go in their house and talk to them. I have actually made great friends of some of my clients over the years. So that background in customer relations has really stood me in good stead.
So in addition to your garden design and installation and maintenance, you are also a garden speaker and author, correct?
Yes. I write a blog called The Garden Diaries, and it's all about what's happening in the garden. It could be a blog about garden trends, garden cooking. I just did one on pumpkins, how to grow winter squash and pumpkins, and I included some recipes. But whatever is happening in my garden, what I'm growing, what I'm excited about, it could be a spotlight on a new plant or shrub, whatever I come up with. And I never run out of subjects. I have too many subjects that I can't write about. So I love to do it. And I write about, I also write articles for magazines. And I also speak at garden club, different groups like civic groups. I go to flower shows like the Philly Flower Show. I've spoken at the Seattle Flower Show I've spoken at. And so I get invited to different events to speak about gardening. And it could be about landscape design. I'm also a floral designer, so I do a lot of demonstrations on floral arranging. So I know my hat seems like it's in all these different rings, but I like to mix it up. I just don't want to do one thing, and that's design gardens. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I do, which is my favorite thing of all, is garden travel. So I've organized two or three trips a year, and I go to different countries. It's always international. It could be England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland. I'm going to Portugal in the spring, in March, and we just go to different gardens. And I usually have a group of like 20 people, of like-minded garden-loving people, and we just get a bus, we stay in hotels, and we'll take 2 weeks and go to every garden that we can have in a certain radius. And, you know, it's so much information for me. I take so many pictures from these trips, and then when I get home, I write about them.
That sounds like a wonderful win-win situation for you, and hopefully we'll be past this COVID situation next March so you can resume the tours. Yeah, I'm sure this year was kind of a bummer to miss out on that.
Yes, I had to cancel two trips, one to Portugal and one to Ireland. So I'm rescheduling them for next year.
Well, that's good that hopefully that can be all back on schedule. And you had mentioned your floral designing passion. Mm-hmm. And I know that you have participated in the White House Christmas decorations several years in a row in the past. Can you describe some of that experience?
Yeah, sure. You know, you just apply to the White House. There's an application online, and you apply in July and August. You find out in October if you've been accepted. You send information about what kind of work you do, pictures of your work. If you're a floral designer, you're more likely to get picked because, of course, you have experience in decorating. So I've done it 3 times for 2 different administrations, and I just go to Washington if I am selected, stay in a hotel, and this is all on your own dime. You pay for your travel, your food, your hotel, and then you stay. Once you stay in your hotel, you just go to the White House for a week every day. It's like 9 to 5, and you just decorate whatever needs doing. It could be making bows, it could be hanging balls on a tree, it could be making wreaths, anything that they ask me to do. So I've done that 3 times, and I have applied this year, and I have not heard if I have been selected. So we'll see.
Yeah, well, do share photos if you do get picked for this year. We'll be interested to see a little preview of that.
Yeah, that's my most read blog ever, is when I decorate the White House and I show all these pictures of it.
Yeah, definitely the behind the scenes is for sure the most interesting part.
Yeah, and that's probably my most popular talk, is the decorating behind the scenes at the White House. A lot of people are curious to know how it's done, and so forth. So that's one of my most popular talks.
And obviously it's a new and different theme depending on the designer and whoever's there every year. Do you get to have any hand in those decisions?
I don't come up with the theme. The White House hires a design company located in Washington, D.C., and that company works on the designs all year long. They come up with, plans for every room, and then they take all that stuff to the White House, meet with the First Lady. She has to approve everything. So they already have decided what's going to be done. But once you get there, they do give you some leeway. Like, for example, I did the blue room mantle. Blue room is the big main room with the big Christmas tree, the 38-foot tall Christmas tree. So they say, Claire, do this mantle. This is what your materials are, but we want you to come up with what you think looks good. And so I did it all by myself, with the materials selected. So you do have some design expertise that they want, because, these designers, they can't be doing every little design that's going to be up at Christmas. So they're relying on their volunteers to help them out.
That's great that you can use some creativity and that's not super micromanaged.
So yeah.
That's wonderful. That is cool. So your passion, of course, are honeybees. And I think your own home property is about 2 acres. Is that correct?
2 acres. Part of it's a meadow. And the meadow part, I planted around my beehives. So they have plenty of forage material. I don't want them to have to fly too far away to find nectar. They can find it right outside their back door. So yeah, I have 2 acres. It's 2 ponds, a big vegetable garden, fruit trees, fruit bushes. And I love to grow dahlias, which I use for flower arranging. So I have a big row of dahlias, and I grow just about everything, every vegetable that we can eat during the summer, and can during August and September and put it up. But my meadow, I created that when I put these hives out my back door, and it surrounds them. It's goldenrod, it could be cornflower, zinnias, whatever wildflower seeds I can come up with. and I replant that every year. So my honeybees have something to snack on.
And so that's completely mowed down, say in late winter, and then seeded with annuals, or do you have perennials in the meadow as well?
It's all annuals, except I do have some perennial milkweed. So I mow it down. This is the thing. You don't want to mow a meadow down too early, because I want that meadow to be up and producing seed heads for birds throughout the winter. So I mow it down in early March, and then I reseed it. I prepare the ground. I reseed it with different annuals, and it grows up again the next year. So it's a cycle that I do every year.
I think we have a third guest on the podcast.
Yes.
I can hear some barking. What is his name or her name?
I got two dogs. I have Tori and Cody. Tori's a border collie. Cody is a mini Aussie. And they are my animal chasers. So if you have deer, and, you know, when I design a garden, that's the first thing I ask a customer. I say, do you have deer? And because that will determine ultimately what I recommend. And I said, you know, the best thing for deer is always a dog, an active dog, not a dog that lazes around. So they keep the deer away from my garden. And a lot of people say, how do the deer not come in and wipe you out? Well, dogs. And groundhogs, you know, groundhogs, they could rip a garden apart really fast. And my border collie, Tori, she just will go after them, and she'll either kill them or chase them off. And as well, she'll do that with squirrels. So my animal problem, which could be huge out here in the country, is very minimal because I have dogs.
That's fabulous. And you're in Baltimore County, correct? So not too far from Ledoux Gardens?
Yeah, actually, I'm about 15 minutes from Ledoux. I'm in northern Baltimore County, and I can travel to Ledoux very quickly. And in fact, I'm working on a post on Ledoux in the fall. So if you are in the county area, the Maryland area, you really should go to Ledoux. It's looking beautiful right now. It's the topiary gardens and the fall foliage, the Japanese anemones, all the topiaries are really, really beautiful at this time of year.
Yes, I can imagine. And that for listeners, Ledoux is spelled L-A-D-E-W. So you could just Google Ledoux or look out for Claire's post on Ledoux Gardens. Mm-hmm. And another garden that just occurred to me that people can visit in the next week or so that's rarely open are the White House Gardens, actually. So they're doing an open garden through the National Park Service, which is the ones who administer the White House grounds, October 17th and 18th. So be on the lookout for those free tickets, those free time passes to look at the vegetable garden and the new rose garden.
Yes, I've been reading up on the new rose garden design. And a lot of people were upset because some crab apples were removed. They weren't killed. They were removed to put someplace else. And I saw the design and I quite liked it. So I have visited the White House in the fall on their free day. And it is very interesting to see the vegetable garden and to see the gardens. You will see trees that are planted on the grounds. Each president plants a tree somewhere on the grounds. And they are signed so you can see which president planted what tree. So that's interesting in itself.
And speaking of our topic of bees, there are also beehives on the White House grounds. And because it's federal property, it's allowed. Where some of the city regulations would not allow beekeeping inside Washington, D.C. in many situations because of how close the houses are to each other.
Yeah.
But on your 2 acres, how many hives do you have?
I have 3, but it fluctuates up and down because bees die. You know, after a winter, I'll go out and say, okay, who's alive? And sometimes I'll have a few hives pull through. Sometimes they'll all die. And then I have to get some new hives in the spring and install them. And that's kind of a funny process because I order the bees through the mail. And, you know, you can get chickens in the mail. So why not bees? So I order my bees and the post office is very excited when they get them and they'll call me at 6 a.m. in the morning and say, Claire, you have to pick up these bees. They are scared to death of them. But, you know, it's just a screened in cage, maybe 12 inches long, full of about 6,000 or 7,000 bees with one queen. And they're just afraid that they're going to get out, which is impossible. They can't get out. So I'll go and pick up my package and come home. And I have my hive set up ready to accept them. It's a brand new home. I spray my hive all with sugar water inside. And I just take this box, pull out, there's a lid with sugar water that's dripping into the mass of bees. I pull that out and then I just dump it. And that really is exciting because you just knock it on the side of the hive as hard as you can and they all clump out into my hive. And that's how I install a hive of bees. It's very easy and anybody can do it. And the price for a package, which I order online, is around $130. So it's not a cheap hobby.
And did you build the hives that you have, or was that a kit or something?
Oh, no, I just get them. There's a local beekeeper that sells hives, and he'll put them together. He buys like pallets of these hives, and he'll put them together, and I'll go. I'm not a carpenter. I can't do that kind of stuff. So I just buy a ready-made hive and whatever else I need from him. It could be a bee brush, it could be a smoker, it could be my bee suit or veil. And so I get all my supplies locally. If I can't find something from him, then I'll order online. There's lots of companies online. But yeah, I get all my, it's called Woodenware, and it's just a wooden hive that you put your bees in.
And you mentioned your veil and your outfit. Do you totally suit up every time?
Oh, no. The only time I really suit up completely is when I extract, because you will have bees going crazy when you extract. They will be zipping around all over. I don't want to get stung. So what I actually use is a paint suit that I get at Home Depot. I don't want to put down $150 for one of these fancy dancy bee suits. So I go to Home Depot and buy the paint suit, which is very, it encloses you totally. It even has feet with a zip up, and it's about $10 for that. And I just use one of them a year and then I'll throw it away and get a new one. But I do buy my veils, and those are very important to keep the bees off your head, your hair, your neck, because you don't want to be stung on your face or scalp. That is extremely painful. So I only suit up if I'm extracting, if I'm looking at the bees, and it's called inspecting your bees, I will put on a veil only. That's to protect my head. But usually I don't have a problem. Sometimes one or two will come out and try to get up my pants legs. And, you know, That happens, but not too often. So I don't really suit up every time, just for extracting.
And do you get occasionally stung?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I get stung, you know, maybe 3 or 4 times a year. And it's really when I'm careless. And the thing about stinging, honeybee sting, is they rarely sting. If you're just walking around, they're not going to sting you. If you're messing with their hive, they're going to sting you. So a lot of people are scared of bees and getting stung because they say they're allergic. But really, everybody swells up if you get stung by any kind of bee. But a honeybee is really a docile insect. If you're stung by a bee, it's usually a hornet, yellow jacket, wasp. Those are the big three that will really nail you. But a honeybee will only sting if you're doing what I'm doing, opening your hive, pulling out your frames of honey and looking at it. They don't like that. So they will sting me. And, you know, I've had, I probably have had dozens of stings over the years. And it still hurts. But if you get the stinger right away, what happens is the honeybee will leave the stinger inside your skin. You take your fingernail and scrape it out. You want to stop the venom from pumping into your body. So the sooner you get the stinger out, the better. And the honeybee is the only bee that will die when it stings you. Hornets and other bees, they can sting you repeatedly. They are not going to die. So honeybee, you know, they're docile. And when I design a garden, people say, well, I don't want bees around my patio, my pool, you know, wherever they're moving around or using the area, because they'll get stung. But I tell them honeybees rarely sting.
And, you know, you get the occasional sting, but what about beekeeping with children? Is that something that you would think would be a good hobby for children?
Well, I really think it's a great hobby for kids. And I'm hearing more and more about during COVID that people are getting out and they want to get their kids out. So I think it's a good hobby to start with your children. I was mentoring a beekeeper, a neighbor, and she has 2 small children, 1 5 and 1 7. And she suited them up. You know, they have veils and suits for kids also, the size of kids. And they were fascinated. And it really is a great education for children to see how this all works, how the insect world is organized, how the girls, and they are females that make the honey, it's not the boys. So that's another education for kids. If you want to get them outdoors and doing something worthwhile and getting honey out of the process, it's a great hobby for kids. They might be a little leery at first, so I would start with baby steps. I would just have them stay away for, you know, maybe 50 feet away. And then each time you open them up, have them come a little bit closer and closer until they get comfortable. If you're comfortable with your bees, they will be comfortable.
And how much time, say a week, or do you check on them regularly in your schedule, or is it less often?
Bees need to be helped along or managed. So from extraction time, which is in August, I really don't do anything. Once I extract the honey, I set them up for the winter. I don't do anything to them, except if there's a dearth of nectar, I might feed them sugar water. And that just means I'm mixing up granulated sugar in water, mixing it up until it becomes a syrup. And then I have a feeder that I put at the entrance and it drips out the sugar water. I'd start doing that in the fall after the frost, because the frost will come and it'll kill a lot of the flowers that the bees are still snacking on. So I'll do that in the fall. And that just takes a few minutes. In the winter, I'm not doing anything to them. I might go up if it's snowing. I will scrape any snow that's piled up in front of the hive. And that's just a few minutes. The bulk of my time is in the spring, because in the spring, that's when they're building up their population. They're bringing in tons of nectar to make their honey. And I have to make sure that, for number one, in the early spring when they wake up and they're really busy out there, I have to make sure that there's flowers out there. If there's not, if it's really early, like early March, and there's nothing blooming, then I again will have to feed them until things start really popping with the flowers. And then in April, May, that's the bulk of my work. And that would be looking into the hive. I want to make sure the queen is healthy. So I pull out my frame of honey. Looking for her. I'm looking for eggs. I want to make sure she's laying eggs. I want to make sure there's new bees in there. I want to make sure they're bringing in nectar. So I'm inspecting that hive. So I'll do that maybe once a week, and that'll take about an hour during the spring to do that. So that's most of the time is in the spring. But then in the fall or August, that's extracting day. And it takes me all day to do that. And that just means I have to clean my buckets. I have to make sure the extractor is functional, clean. Everything has to be very clean when I extract the honey. I have to set it all up. I put plastic down in my garage. I put out soapy water, and it's always the hottest day of the year because I want to make sure that the honey is going to flow out of the comb. The hotter it is, the higher temperature, the easier that honey is going to flow. So I put the frames in the extractor, and frame is just think of a long honeycomb. I put the frames in extractor. It has a little motor, and it spins, and it flings the honey on the sides of the extractor. Think of a big trash can-like thing. The honey flows down to the bottom where there's a valve. I open the valve, and the honey flows out into a bucket. So that is all day, because I have to pull the frames off the hives. And then I have to extract it. Then I have to clean up. And then I'm doing wax. I'm cutting up wax for melting and cleaning. So that is all day in August. So, you know, it does take time. It's not something where you're going to be hands off. You really have to pay attention to your bees during the spring, summer months.
And when you're extracting, do you bottle up that honey right away? Do you do anything else to the honey?
Well, what I do is I strain it. And when you strain it, it's just like a sieve that you use for cooking, but it sits over a bucket. And it double strains it, and it strains out the particles of wax. I don't want any wax in there, and dead bees and pieces of bees. So I don't want my honey to have dead bees in it. So I strain that out. But that's really the only processing that I do to the honey. And then once it goes in the bucket, it kind of has like a foam on top. Think of making jelly in a big pot and there's foam on top. That's kind of what it looks like. So I want that foam to settle down. I'll skim it off if it's really thick. And then I just let it sit for about a week. And then I'm out there with all my bottles. I have to get tons of bottles to do this. And I extracted 180 pounds this year, which wow. is the most I've ever done, ever. And it was from two hives. The third hive didn't produce anything for me. So that's a lot of bottles. And honey is, it's by the pound. You get it like a 1 pounder, 2 pounder, or 3 pounder jar. So I fill all those jars, and that takes a lot of time, is to fill your jars. And then I make labels. I design my own sticky labels that I had printed, and it has my name and it has some graphics and that kind of thing. And then I have to put a label on it, and then I sell it.
And for local honey, there's some special benefits, right, for getting honey right. that's local to just your area, as opposed to maybe when you would travel and buy some honey there.
Yeah, local honey. Now, I don't know about any scientific studies, but it is supposed to help you with allergies. So think of it this way. You're eating honey that has been gathered, the nectar has been gathered from all the local flowers. It could be goldenrod, cornflower, zinnias. It's just this whole variety of flowers that they are collecting from. It's not like in California in the almond orchards where the honeybee is just taking from nectar from the almond tree. This is like this mixture of wildflowers from my yard, and they can go up to 6 miles away collecting different nectars. So I really can't label it with a name other than wildflower. And people are said, it says that you should eat honey locally, because that will give you an immunity to local allergies. It should build up your resistance to the allergens in the air locally. I don't know how scientific that is, but a lot of people swear by it.
Mm-hmm. And that would have to be, of course, raw, unpasteurized honey, or or it wouldn't have that pollen in there.
Yeah, it has to be, yes, because it does have pollen in it. Think of the honey. It has a lot of nutrients. It has trace amounts of like different things like zinc and whatever. There's a whole list of things that it has in it. It's not just, don't think of it as just sugar water. It has so many good things in it, has the pollen. It will have some tiny bits of wax that I didn't filter out. The pollen, so you're eating pollen from the plants that surround you. And, you know, I swear by it. I don't have problems with allergies. I used to suffer greatly from allergies, but I eat a lot of honey.
That's great to know. And that does kind of answer my question of, I always see local honeys labeled with, say, it'll say Tupelo honey or orange blossom. And I always wondered how a beekeeper, it's not like you're wrangling these bees.
No.
Telling them what type of flowers to go to and come back to. So I always wondered how they knew that it was just specifically this kind of honey, even though it might have a slightly different taste, like orange blossom versus honey locust, say.
Yeah, well, honeys have a wide variety of taste and color. So if you're getting like buckwheat flowers, buckwheat flour produces the darkest, like it's almost like tar honey, and it's supposed to be really good for you, but I can't stomach it. It's really strong. So that's the buckwheat. But then the clover, the orange blossom, they're very light colored. So think of the pollen and nectar from that type of flower. A clover flower has very light nectar, but a buckwheat flower has very dark nectar. So my honey, I compare it every year that I extract. Sometimes it's darker than others. Sometimes I think they're getting my goldenrod and it becomes a little darker, earthier tasting. So that really determines the taste of your honey. But if you buy clover honey, they are getting it from a clover field. The honeybees are situated in a clover field.
Mm-hmm. And usually they're going for the closest pollen sources.
The closest, most accessible nectar. They don't want to do more work than they have to.
And I also heard that bees go for, on a run, only one type of flower. So say from one lavender to another lavender to another lavender, they don't do lavender, cosmos, goldenrod, back.
Very good, Kathy. You've done your homework. they are consistent with that. So they're going to go to one flower only, exhaust that source, go back to their hive, and then they do the dance, you know, the little waggle dance. If they found a good source, they're going to spin around in circles. And I have seen them do this. It's pretty funny. And they'll waggle, and they will tell the other bees in the hive where that source is, where that good nectar is. And they will actually tell them how far away it is, where it's oriented, if it's northeast, whatever direction it is, they have this down to an art. They will tell them exactly where to go.
And it's really interesting that they're going for one at a time and then kind of exhausting that source. So for our own home gardens, it sounds like we should plant on moss and not just onesie twosies.
Yeah. You know, I always tell people if they only have a container for their bees that they want the bees to come to, just plant one thing in it, because the bees, again, they want to see a big, big block of it. If you have a garden, I would plant in blocks of 3 to 4 feet at least. So if you're designing a perennial garden, I would say that would take at least a 9 to 12 plants to do a block that large, depending on the perennial. So do it in big, big blocks so they can see it, smell it, and use it. They're not going to come to one zinnia. They want a lot of nectar source.
And what about early and late season blooms? Do you have any suggestions for that, or maybe shrubs and trees in addition to what we think of as the annuals and perennials that honeybees usually frequent?
Early and late, I call that the shoulder season. That is when it's the hardest for them to find nectar. So I've had my bees out in February. If we get a warm day, say over 50 degrees, they're out flying looking for flowers. Well, what's blooming in February? Not much. But Mahonia is a great plant. It's not native, but it's a great plant that they can gather pollen. And pollen is also food for bees as well as nectar. So you want things that are going to bloom in the early season. Hellebores is another thing that will bloom very early. Think of your bulbs like crocus, tulips. And I'm sure we've all seen tulip with black anthers. That's the inside part of the flower. They collect that pollen and it's black, and they bring that home to their hive. So whenever I see black pollen, I know it's from a tulip. So you want to think of things that bloom early as well as late, because late is another time when it's hard for things, for the honeybees to find things. So think of goldenrod. Asters. Oh my gosh, the asters in my garden look glorious now. The eupatorium, Joe Pye weed, Asclepias, they bloom late. Anything that blooms like in September, October, anemones. The anemones are blooming, they bloom in September, October. Mm-hmm. Also, colony or turtle head, that blooms really late. So think of all these things that bloom, I would say from now on to the end of the season that honeybees can collect nectar from.
Yeah, I know the blue mist shrub, the Caryopteris, I call that my bee ball.
Yeah.
You can't even walk by it on a pathway because it is just covered with honeybees.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and butterfly bushes, all those things. There's some Heliopsis, that's the false sunflower. Mm-hmm. They're blooming. Yeah, I just go out in my garden and see what's blooming, and the bees are on it. They're collecting from it. Toad lily, that's another one. Tricertis. Yeah, yeah, that blooms actually in November, October, November. So the bees love it. It's a tiny little orchid purple flower, mm-hmm. And it's small, but the bees really cover it.
And it's a perennial, and it's pretty frost-proof versus a lot of annuals that, you know, should we get an early frost, might end some of that blooming.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Because here in Maryland, our frost, I don't know, Kathy, you have to back me up on this. My frost comes around a week before Halloween.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mid to late October is our average for first frost. Maybe not a killing frost.
Yeah, but a light frost.
But at least a light frost. Yeah.
And so that's my signal. As soon as the frost comes and it kills my annuals, then I'm making sugar water syrup to feed my bees because I know they're still active. It's still over 50 degrees during the day, and they will starve if I don't feed them unless they have enough honey stored. So that's another thing. When I extract honey, I don't take it all. I have to make sure that they have enough left in their hive to survive the winter. So that's my balancing act. I want to make sure they have enough left and I don't take it all. I can't be greedy because if I'm greedy and take all their honey, they will starve and then I have to buy a new hive in the spring.
And that's great advice, not just for bees, but for a lot of cultivation in the garden is to not always take all, like not all the seed heads, not all the fruits off a tree. To use what you can and then leave a portion.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh. And that is so true with bees. I want them to live through the winter, and it's the only insect, a honeybee is the only insect that lives through the winter in its full form. Other bees and insects, they're either their larva form, but honeybees, they will live through the winter, and if it's 0 degrees outside, that hive is 95 degrees inside. They keep it warm by beating their wings. So that hive, I want to make sure they have enough food in there to continue to beat their wings and keep it warm, because they can starve and then freeze to death.
Yeah, I can imagine that takes a ton of energy.
Yep.
So the extracting device that you described earlier, do you own that or do you share one? Because you only sound like you might use it once a year.
Yeah.
Or even once a season. Would say a local honeykeepers club share one of those or pass it around, or do you want to have it sanitary and just for your own use?
Well, I used to share it. I belong to a bee club, and I recommend anybody who keeps bee to join one. All our meetings are on Zoom right now, and I learn so much from more experienced beekeepers. And when I say that, I've been doing this 20 years, but there's beekeepers who've been doing it a lot longer. And they know more than I do. So I can go to them for help. So I used to share it because extractors are expensive. But I got tired of sharing and it wouldn't work or it was dirty when I got it. So I bought one and it was $400. It was well worth it. And it's motorized. I just plug it in. You turn it on to spin it. So you don't have to do that right away. I would say if you start out with beekeeping, get the club's extractor and make sure you really, really want to do this. But since I've been doing it so long, I decided to buy one on my own.
Yeah, that's great advice to try it out for your first year.
Yeah.
So you know how much work it is and you don't have to put that full investment in right away. Is there any new technology coming on the horizon for beekeeping that you're like, oh, I want this for my hive?
Oh, yeah. I want a flow hive. And everybody, it was the Facebook darling for, 2 years. And flow hive just simply means it was these guys in Australia. They invented this hive where the there's windows in the side so you can look in. And they're covered with plexiglass, so you don't worry, the bees won't get out. But you can see how they're doing. Are they bringing in the right amount of nectar? Are they bringing in pollen? And the flow hive, also, they have these special frames. Remember, those are the honeycombs. And instead of me pulling out a frame and putting it in the extractor, which is a lot of work, they can just flip a switch and it splits the frame apart inside your hive and it releases the honey. It actually cracks the wax that's on top of the honey and the honey starts flowing out and it comes out a spout into a jar which you put in front of your beehive. So that is a brand new, it's been around for about 5 years, and I actually mentored a friend who has a flow hive, and it's pretty cool, but it's really expensive. Another thing that I use is a Bluetooth battery probe that you put in your hive. It measures the temperature of the hive, and so I can pick up it's sitting in my house, the temperature inside my house, hives outside. And that's really important because if I notice in the middle of the winter that the temperature is fluctuating, going down, that tells me they're not doing well. And I might do something to help them, like feed them sugar. And there's also one other thing. It's a scale you can put under your hive and it weighs the hive. So think of this in the spring. Oh, it may weigh 60 pounds, but every time they're bringing in nectar and creating this honey, it gets heavier and heavier and heavier. So you know that this hive is, they're working hard and it might be time to extract it. So those are the three things that I can think of that I would like to have. They're expensive. It's not necessary. You can do all this without it, but it's just, these different technologies that make your life a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm. They do sound pretty cool.
Yeah. if I had an unlimited budget, I'd have 10 flow hives.
And all that honey.
And all of that honey. Yeah.
That'd be the best. Right. Well, thank you so much, Claire, for sharing about your beekeeping experiences and letting beginners know how easy it is and what the process is. And how can people contact you?
Well, they can contact me by going on my website, and it's clairejoneslandscapes.com. And you can, there's a contact form on there they can fill out. You can go on my blog, which is thegardendiaries.com or .blog, I should say. And you can contact me through that. You can email me. My email is jonesb1@comcast.net. You can go on my Instagram feed, which is Belle Claire, The Garden Diaries. Belle Claire's just a street I live on. So any of those methods work for me. I'd love to talk to you if you have any questions. I would love to help you out. If you need somebody to mentor you for beekeeping, I could help you find a mentor too.
Wonderful. That's so generous of you, Claire.
Oh, I love being on. I love talking about bees, and it's great cocktail conversation. Anytime I'm at a party and somebody knows that I'm a beekeeper, I have instant conversation with them. they want to know everything about beekeeping.
Yeah, honeybees are such fascinating creatures.
They are. They are. And you never learn everything about them. I'm always learning something new.
That sounds like a wonderful hobby to have in addition to gardening.
Yeah, well, it's all part of gardening, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like an offshoot of gardening.
Thank you again, Claire.
Thank you for having me, Kathy.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter by going to anchor.fm/Kathy-Gents/support. For as little as 99 cents a month, you can become a listener supporter, and we'll give you a shout out in a future episode. Another way to support Garden DC is to go to WashingtonGardener.com and subscribe to Washington Gardener Magazine.
Asters Plant Profile. Asters are a hardy perennial that mostly bloom in late summer and autumn in the Mid-Atlantic region. Asters are native to Europe and North America. There are over 600 species in the Asteraceae family. They are deer-resistant, easy to grow, and vigorous plants. The flowers are daisy-like in shape and come in shades of white, pink, lavender, and blue, with a yellow center. The most popular variety is the New England aster. Other popular aster varieties include Woods Blue, Monk, and October Skies. Their use in the garden is mostly as a filler plant in borders. They tend to get leggy and flop, so stake them or place them next to a plant or other feature that they can lean on. Look for some of the shorter, bushier cultivars to avoid the flopping. You can also try pinching them or cutting them back in late June to control their height. Asters prefer full sun and well-drained soil. Once established, they are fairly drought tolerant. They attract butterflies, pollinators, and make good cut flowers as well. I wanted to let you know about some upcoming webinars that we are hosting through Washington Gardener Magazine. They'll all be held via Zoom, and once you register, you get a confirmation and a link to the Zoom connection. If you can't participate live in the webinar, you'll be able to access the recording for a couple weeks after they take place, so don't worry if the date doesn't work for you. Our next one is Sunday, October 4th at 2 p.m., and that's dealing with deer and other mammal pests in your garden. There is a registration at washingtongardener.blogspot.com. If you just go to the search field in the upper left and enter webinar or webinars, you should see the last few webinar listings and a link for the registration there. All the webinars are a low fee of $10 each. And the next one after that is Sunday, November 1st at 2 p.m. And that's Small Trees and Large Shrubs for Urban and Small Gardens. And our final one for the year is Sunday, December 6th, again at 2 p.m., A Truly Green Holiday, a talk on seasonal plants with a bulb-forcing demo in addition. And that's a little bonus there to get some nice flowering plants inside in late winter if you force them around the holiday season. I also wanted to put it out there that I am speaking to many garden clubs this COVID pandemic season via Zoom, and you can contact me for speaking to your club or group through greatgardenspeakers.com. My listing is under Kathy Jentz, and my last name is spelled J-E-N-T-Z. Thanks for listening. This week's What's Blooming in the Garden, I thought I'd share two native plants in the aster family that are blooming all over my garden, even where I didn't plant them. Those are white snakeroot and white wood aster. And from the name, obviously, both have white flowers. They're also beloved by pollinators. I see a lot of tiny native bees and flies on the flowers. They are fairly tall, 2 to 3 feet. They bloom in part shade and sometimes even full shade, and they don't mind the dry conditions under my oak trees as well. So it's one of those native plants that kind of pops up, you know, every once in a while throughout the garden if you let it reseed, especially the white snakeroot. White wood aster, a little less, and might need a little more sun for full blooming, and doesn't even mind full sun in dry conditions. But both plants have their place in the fall garden, and they're easy enough to pull and discard a few if they're getting to be too big in numbers throughout your garden. White snakeroot and white wood aster, a nice exclamation point in your fall garden borders.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
You can find Washington Gardener online at washingtongardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDCGardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.